I am Claire Mitchell, Doctor of Laws and King's Counsel.
And I am Zoe Venditozzi, Doctor of Laws, teacher and writer.
On the 8th of March 2020, International Women's Day, we launched the Feminist Witches of Scotland campaign. The Witchcraft Act, enforced between 1563 and 1736, saw thousands of people, mostly women, accused and executed as witches in Scotland, in the country's biggest and most brutal miscarriage of justice. Our campaign had three aims: to get a formal state apology for those accused of witchcraft, to obtain a pardon for all those convicted, and to get a national memorial to remember those involved in the Witchcraft Act.
On International Women's Day 2022, the first of our aims was realised when First Minister Nicola Sturgeon issued a formal state apology to those accused as witches. The first formal state apology ever. We are currently working with politicians to ensure there's legislation passed to pardon those accused as witches, to change their status from convicted witches to those who ought never to have been prosecuted. We continue our work to obtain a national monument so those who suffered will never be forgotten. Join us as we speak to the experts on the witchcraft trials, both here in Scotland and further abroad, as we explore the history of women in Scotland and continue the cultural conversation of what it means to be a woman. Hello and welcome to the Witches of Scotland. Rather improbably, and to repeat the same joke we've now been making for quite some time, episode 69 of 6. Would you credit it, Claire? We're still working away.
I mean, incredulous would be an understatement.
It just seems ridiculous, really, at this point. But we show no signs of actually stopping.
No, speeding up, if anything.
Yes, we've recorded several episodes the last few weeks, and we've got tons more people, and there's just more happening all the time. So if you're sitting listening to this going, good God, when is this going to finish? I gave it 6 episodes. I find myself listening again. Listen, keep going.
There's no time soon.
I know. And this is a good one today as well. I mean, we always say that because they are always good ones. But this is a good one today. And just a little apology in advance. It will mean another book to buy. Okay. Or, as I'd like to point out at this point, libraries are wonderful things. I know I always say this, but please, please borrow from libraries, because remember that the writer gets a bit of money every time a book's borrowed from the library. And the more people borrow it from the library, the more people talk about it. And then librarians can recommend it and so on. So remember, you can use your library, and we have to keep using them so we don't lose them.
Yeah.
So, well, anyway,
when you speak to writers, they're always delighted about people using libraries, which is a wee bit counterintuitive, because you must think, well, surely they want to buy the book, but they want people to read what they've written and enjoy it above all.
Yeah. And I think it's really important that we just keep using these public services so they're not disappeared. Yeah. So please do borrow them from the library. Okay, anyway, back to our usual programming. Claire, just wondering, what's going on in witch-related news areas that you've come across this week?
News!
I'm actually going to ask Luca, my son, to make a little bit of audio for a news clip. It's exhausting listening to you singing that every episode.
What are you trying to say?
I'm saying it's like watching Montserrat Caballé. Was that her name?
Yes.
I just completely made up.
No.
Like, just given the performance of a lifetime, and I just don't think it's fair on you, Claire, to give that much energy each time.
I've been gargling with glycerin since 6 this morning.
Well, it's worked.
And like atomizing or whatever it is that they do.
I hope you're going to treat yourself to a nice soothing drink after this.
I will. So, I will.
Anyway, what has been happening in news, with it being one of the cultural happenings of the year in Scotland?
The biggest cultural event in Scotland of the year, certainly the biggest, and one of the biggest in the world, Edinburgh Festival. Now, there are a few people getting in contact with us about other festival events. Not unsurprisingly, given the cultural conversation that we've got going on, Zoe, there are so many people who are now talking about the witchcraft trials, interested in them. I mean, in fairness, obviously, there were people talking about them a long time before we came along. But there are a number of higher profile events that we want to give even more prominence to and tell people about. And the first of those today is once again play called Prick. It's at venue 39 on the space on the mile, and it's at 11:15 most days, not all days, so have a check. We got an update from Laura Flanagan Heggy of the production, who told us a wee bit more about the play, Zoe, and she said that puppet artist Madeline Helling and Laura Flanagan Heggy visited Edinburgh at the end of April to deliver the puppets, because it's part interactive with puppets, the puppets and workshop with the cast. She said,
fascinating, actually. Sorry, it's fascinating, the idea they've got these puppets. I think it's going to give it an extra dimension.
It is, and I've seen photographs of them, and they are amazing, amazing looking things. What Laura says is, at the beginning of May, the cast had a fully staged Fringe preview performance at the theatre department at Edinburgh and Napier, which was the first full look of the production. And it was deemed, and this is a quote, a beautiful piece of storytelling. The production is the thesis project for Meggie Greville's directing MFA, having the endorsement of her professors at Napier. And this is an important part of the process for her. We wanted to know a wee bit more about the puppets, and the information that she gave us was that from the beginning of the process, she knew that the witch pricker would be central to the story. And she said that before she understood what that meant in this world, she wanted to physically distance the actors from experiencing harm or subjecting the audience to watching women on stage being pricked or physically harmed. The cast is three women and three men. Each of the women has a scene in what's described as liminal space, where they're conjured from memory and face a pricker. Inside the liminal space, inside their sort of the showing on stage of their thinking, the women have monologues where they remember their interrogation. And the accused, the puppet, essentially stands in for each woman as she faces the pricker, allowing the actor to watch her memories unfold. So she says it's interesting, they've discovered in plays it's as if the characters are disassociating in these moments, echoing how some victims of trauma describe their own experiences during traumatic events. She says they're also animal puppets. Each woman has a familiar, a cat, a fox, and of course, interesting for you, Zoe, a jackdaw. And also there are a flock of jackdaws which appear in the transition between scenes. The three women who appear in the spaces are the unknown women, one of what we highlighted early on in our campaign as the Sundry Witches. Marion Tweedy, who never confessed, and Isabel Gowdy. Some of the other characters in the play include Old Nick, King James, a farmer, a grave digger, a pricker, TV personalities Janet and Jonet. Now, I think they've missed a turn there not calling them Zoe and Claire, but you know. Zoe's making a face like Janet and Jonet aren't the best names. And various ensemble roles. Moreover, and even more beautifully, Heal and Harrow gave permission for them to use some of their music, the final song on their album, which underscores the final scene and plays out at the end. The cast is self-producing, and this piece for the Fringe is a part of their master's course. They've created a production company, which we've interacted with online, called Light the Match Productions. And what they've said really kindly is they are totally into the play and the campaign, and they're excited and happy to be working on a project centred on such an important subject. They've also said that if anyone out there has suggestions of groups or organisation or academics that aren't on social media, but you think would be interested in this, please do spread the word. So we would definitely recommend. We haven't seen it ourselves, of course, but we hear about it, don't we? Absolutely. And what we hear about it is very good. So we really look forward and going to see that. And I should say, just because I've been in London of late, a great shout out once again to the Crucible at the Gielgud Theatre in London. 5-star National Theatre production. The tickets are expensive, but if you go on the day or you get tickets up in the gods or something like that, they are a lot cheaper. They're still not cheap for a day out, unfortunately, but that seems to be the going rate for these sorts of things. But if you were to be in London and were looking for a play, highly recommend it.
I wonder whether they'll do that thing. They may have done it already, but I just haven't seen it advertised, where, you know, when they blast out, they play the show through different cinemas, because sometimes the DTA in Dundee does that. It's really good for it. So maybe they'll do that as well.
Yeah, I think I saw, was it Frankenstein's Monster? I think I saw that at the start of the lockdown Benedict Cumberbatch, and it was amazing. I watched it on TV. I so hope they do that. And if they do, put it on either on cinemas or allow you to like watch on TV, giving you YouTube link and something, highly recommend it. It's a really, really good production.
I'd really like to talk to somebody that's making the production of that as well. It's really interesting seeing these different interpretations of like different aspects of the witch. Crucible is the one that everybody always talks about when we talk about the campaign.
Let's contact them and see if they'll speak to us.
Let's do it. That'd be a good idea. And then when we're down in London, I'm really hoping I can go and see it as well.
We've got some news about an upcoming book festival, don't we, Zoe?
So this is the Burning Book Festival, which will be appearing on the afternoon of the 21st of October. Helen Harrow will also be there. They're having a real kind of focus on, I would say, sort of folklore and storytelling and that side of things of Scottish culture. I think it'll be really interesting. So we're very excited to be going there and doing that one, especially because, you know, Burning Woods and Macbeth and so on. That's a really interesting link. So the team there is brilliant, really enthusiastic, and it's a fantastic team of volunteers, I think, that are working really hard to create something special. So as we get closer to that, we'll give you links for tickets and that sort of thing. But it might be something you want to pencil into your diary at this moment.
Pencil into your file of fax.
The 21st of October. And I think it's on the whole weekend. I'm under the impression it's on like maybe two nights and during the days. And there's a whole bunch of really interesting stuff. And as we get closer to the time, we'll start sharing information about that and how you can buy tickets and so on. Our final thing today is referring back to this really interesting case that's been happening in Connecticut. The state representative, Doug Dubitsky, was sort of seen as being somebody who was not keen on things changing. And it seemed the way that things were written at the time that he was having a problem with the pardon and so on, because he believed in witches. However, since this case has come to light and since he initially was speaking, he wants to make it very clear that he does not believe in witches. OK, so this is a quote from him from a recent interview that he did, where he said, "There are plenty of people in this day and age who think there is such a thing as witchcraft. I don't happen to be one of them." So it's unusual that he's clarified that, but it was prompted by when he was objecting to the bill currently before the Connecticut state legislature. He was worried that it made him look sort of foolish and green, and that he believed in witches, and that he wasn't keen to exonerate the residents of Connecticut who had been convicted in the 1600s. What Dubitsky was particularly concerned about was the wording of the bill. He didn't feel it was clear enough exactly what they were talking about when they talked about crimes related to witchcraft. And he wanted to know clearly what was going on with the new bill. And I can understand that, because we have had some concerns from some people about the pardon that we're looking for in Scotland, where people get a little bit mixed up and think, well, if they weren't guilty of that, they were probably guilty of something else. But as lawyers, Claire and I always come back to this and say, we must be precise with what we're accusing people of. So you can't just say, you know, witchcraft, and it covers a, like a sort of a variety of criminal ill doings. You can only accuse and then, you know, like, you know, find somebody guilty of a particular crime. But I think Mr. Dubitsky was keen to find out exactly what was being covered there.
Yeah, so what he also said, Zoe, was that, I mean, obviously he didn't have much time for it, because he said that that he was concerned to know about that, but also that other people have questioned whether or not that type of legislature is the best use of lawmakers' time when women currently in this day and age are facing other threats. Now, if it was an either-or situation, do you want to make laws protecting women, or do you want to exonerate, because we're in the US, women who are accused of witchcraft, or do we want to pass laws to protect women now? Well, it'd be a no-brainer. We would want laws to protect women now, but it doesn't need to be an either-or situation.
No, and we keep saying this, you know, we're perfectly capable of having several ideas at the same time. And also the argument that we would always make and that we do make, and it goes back to the apology that the First Minister gave on International Women's Day, is that the way we treat women now hasn't just occurred. It's based on years of a particular way of viewing and dealing with, in quotes, women. So we think that if we look at the witchcraft trials and look at the way that was done, that could impact on a more positive way of treating women in society.
Yeah, and also I've found that certainly in the UK, people that pop up and say, oh, well, you should be doing things for women now, are clearly the sort of people who themselves aren't doing anything for women's rights.
Yeah, I mean, these are people that like to say, oh, you should be spending your time doing such and such. And you're like, right, okay, so what are you doing about such and such? Oh, nothing. I'm just pissing about on the internet telling you how you're wrong. Okay, well, maybe use your time more positively
See
or
when.
shut your pie hole.
See, when people say a QC like you shouldn't be wasting their time doing stuff like this, and I'm like, you'd
You
be
should be doing
pure raging.
Sudoku.
Yeah, you should pure raging to see me on a Sunday afternoon sitting in my joggies watching whatever comes on next in Netflix.
Surely you want me to use my skills for something good as well. Anyway, so this bill, the one in Connecticut, is part of a little's maybe the wrong word, a growing movement that's happening. So nearly 400 years after the witch trials that we are slightly familiar with in Scotland, because we know we have this idea when we know about the Crucible, New England states have been introducing and passing legislation looking for exonerations for the convicted. Last year, during an amendment to their budget, Massachusetts finally exonerated Elizabeth Johnson Jr., who was the last person in Salem to be convicted, and she'd not had her name cleared. That's a really interesting case. And there's a bill currently pending in New Hampshire, before their legislature, to exonerate Eunice Goody Cole, the only Granite Stater, so that's what they're known as there in New Hampshire, ever convicted of witchcraft. So it's really interesting. You know, we as I've discussed, there have been a few people, naysayers, one might describe them, who think, you know, that they shouldn't be wasting time, as Claire said. All I can say is, if we are still facing threats as women, and we are, the more we talk about this and the more that we can use past events as a lens to kind of look through things. Now, obviously, we're not the same, but we are still humans. And it's not that long ago, really, in the grand scale of things. And we know that there are people, usually women, still being accused of witches today. So that as long as that's going on, it's not wasted time, because if it makes people talk about it, it makes people aware about it. And that can only be a good thing, because hopefully we will grow as women and
And
humans.
as men.
Yeah, and as men. Exactly.
Now, Zoe, we usually do Women Not Witches in Scotland, but we're going to do today a London edit. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, you vagued out for a second there. I asked the question, why are we doing a London edition, Claire?
Well, it's because I've been down in London for the past few weeks working. And, you know, just wherever I go, I always want to find out what was the story of witchcraft here. And I know that witchcraft was not such a big thing in England as it was in Scotland, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. And so I wanted to find out a wee bit more about women accused of witchcraft. Happily, there were much fewer, even in a big city like London, but I was able to come up with a few women accused as witches. Now, I've looked up online and I found a great article by a man called John Rabun, Rabon, and it's called The Hexing of London. And he sets out a big historical background, and he mentions some names that are also mentioned elsewhere on the internet, but his is a good jumping off point if you want to read that article. So basically, he let us know that in England, it was Henry VIII that passed the Witchcraft Act of 1541. You'll remember, of course, it was James VI of Scotland in 1563 for us.
Can I just jump in annoyingly at this
You
point?
can.
This is just a geeky reader thing. So in Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, who's the most wonderful writer, and if you haven't already read Wolf Hall, I suspect that there'll be lots and lots of listeners that'll be right up their street who've got an interest in history. And Mantel was so good at writing historical characters in a way that completely modernized them, sort of in a way. Modernized is the wrong word, but they just you don't view them as just historical figures. You know, it's like they're so alive and they're just so deeply unpleasant at so many points. But it's really interesting because in Wolf Hall, the first one, there is a bit about witches, and there's a bit where Cromwell, who's the main character, sees a woman who I don't think is a witch, but he sees her being burnt in the street, and it's a really like a really horrible part of his sort of like early teens, I think.
Oh
it is
my God.
It's really interesting the way that it's written. And I always remember I read that before we started the campaign, and it came back to me as a really evocative idea about, you know, like what drives a society to kill somebody in that manner, you know, and the effect that has on a society generally. So I always like to recommend to people to read Wolf Hall. But it's interesting, I hadn't realized that about Henry VIII. And of course, his relationship with women and his way of viewing women. So his second wife, what was she called? I've forgotten now because I'm so crap with details.
There's an acronym, but I've now also forgotten the acronym, which doesn't help.
I never was taught that. But so he was married to the first one, and then that was like dissolved. He pretended that they'd never really be married. That was his brother's widow that he married. But then he married again, and the way she's portrayed in the BBC series of Wolf Hall is really interesting. Was it Claire Foy, maybe? But he then, when he got rid of their marriage, one of the things he said was that she'd bewitched him, that she was like a witch, and that she'd used like supernatural powers. And really, the only supernatural power she'd had was that he wanted to have sex. So I think like, that was the main thing. But that was the reason that he was able to get rid of that marriage as well, and why one of the reasons why ultimately she was executed. So there was accusations then. So he obviously, it would be convenient to somebody like Henry to view witches as, you know, troublemakers that one can dispatch when one's had enough. Anyway, sorry to have jumped in that rambly manner.
No, that's exactly the chat I want to hear. I'm fascinated. I am one of the people who has not read Wolf Hall, to my shame.
It's so good, right? I know that they're totally massive, the books, right? Which is off-putting because they are huge, and there's a lot of information in them, and you have to kind of understand all the different characters that are in it. But honestly, they absolutely repay the watching. And I always say to people, if you can find on iPlayer or somewhere the BBC adaptation with Mark Rylance.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
It's totally worth watching that, I think, first, because then, well, for me personally, I'm in love with Mark Rylance. I love him so much. I once had the great good fortune of meeting him very briefly backstage at the Edinburgh Book Festival.
Oui.
And I hope Mark isn't listening to this because this is slightly embarrassing. But I'm calling him Mark. We're not friends, obviously. And he wouldn't remember me. It was like 2 seconds. But if Mark Rylance had said to me, and now he's a lot older than me, and he's quite small and he's kind of twinkly, I would say. If Mark Rylance had said to me, and I was married at this point, would you run away with me? I would have said, anywhere, Mark. He's so charismatic. I just think he's amazing. And part of that was because of how good he was in Wolf Hall. I just think he's an amazing actor. And Wolf Hall, the TV series, is really dark. So it's, I think part of their thinking was it's lit in the way that it would have been lit in the day.
There were complaints about it because people were like, what's the point in having a TV show in the dark?
Yeah, but it's really like authentic and amazing. And there's also a really good documentary where Hilary Mantel is talking about the writing of it. Honestly, I'm sorry to be an English teacher, right? But I must insist that everybody immediately reads Wolf Hall.
That's fine, because we've hardly had any complaints about all the books that people are having to read of the podcast. So I'm sure they won't mind another one.
Won't mind at all. And the trilogy. So it's, you know, you're starting off on that one, and then you can jump off if you've not already read Hilary Mantel's other books, all her other amazing books, because she was really varied as a writer. And in fact, one of her books, Beyond Black, I'm really banging on now, but Beyond Black is an amazing book. It's one of my favourite books, and it really inspired me with one of the books that I read. Well, it was sort of inspired me. I'd already started writing it, but that's about a psychic who travels around the M25 doing different shows. And that definitely would be something that I think the people that have an interest in the witch trials would find really interesting, because these are women that probably would have been accused of being witches. And it also kind of echoes the Hellish Nell storyline as well, about Helen Duncan, although it's set in a fairly modern day. So
what
a great loss to us that Hilary Mantel died so young, because she was just the most wonderful writer. And I honestly do genuinely frequently think about what else we could have had ahead of us from Hilary Mantel, because she was such a total genius, and I do not use that word lightly.
Well, it's nice that we remember her as well.
Oh, beautiful writer. Like, and had a really hard time with things with her health and stuff, and still wrote these absolutely amazing books. So, yeah. Sorry, that's a complete dog leg.
No. It's all good, and we're remembering more. I'll tell you that also, after Henry VIII passed the Witchcraft Act, obviously James VI down in Scotland passed the Witchcraft Act in 1563, but in London it wasn't until 1599 that a woman called Anne Carke was tried and convicted and then hanged. Now, what was interesting about this, Zoe, was that apparently the Bishop of London wasn't convinced that she was a witch. But even with
Right.
such a high prestige man, a man of the church, a man of the cloth, saying that he wasn't convinced, it did not save her from being executed as a witch. King James VI of Scotland took over the English throne in 1603. And as of course we know, he brings with him a long history of witchcraft interest, writing the book Demonology and being involved in so many Scottish witchcraft trials. So when he came to the throne, unite the Scottish and English throne in 1603, there was a renewed interest in witchcraft trials in England. We're told that a notable trial in London was that of Elizabeth Sawyer in 1621. Now, the reason that this stuck in my memory, Zoe, when I was reading about it, was that Elizabeth was accused of being lured into committing the devil's work. Now, that in itself is not unusual, but she was lured by a dog named Tom.
I mean, so, like, the was the dog, like, the devil?
No, the dog was Tom. Keep up.
Okay, but how, like, did the dog talk to her?
Well, I presume the dog must have had some chat with the devil, and the devil said, "Why don't you look lively and pop down to Elizabeth and see if you can get her to come over and do my work?" And somehow the dog did this. Now, we joke about this, but unfortunately, that nonsense was believed. And she was executed at no less place than Marble Arch. So I didn't know there were any witchcraft accusations there executions. So that's interesting to know. Another witch accused was a man in the 17th century called Nicholas Culpeper. He was a pharmacist. And sort of gave out, you know, remedies, etc. And he was accused by one of his patients in 1643. His workplace was in Shoreditch, and they accused him of magic by giving out a potion. Now, what's interesting about that was he was acquitted. And I wonder, Zoe, if people like that were sometimes acquitted because the local populace needed people who would give out lotions and potions to help them with things. Therefore, he's a useful member of society. I don't, obviously, it's speculation, but I found it interesting that of the people mentioned, the person who wasn't executed was somebody who was providing value in the terms of he was supplying people with drugs that they thought helped them. I wonder if that had anything to do with it. Then we're told about a woman called Joan Peterson, who it's said was called the Witch of Wapping. Now, she had somewhat of a checkered history with the law. She was accused of having conversations with a squirrel. I'll just pause there to recall your conversations with the ravens and the raccoons.
Well, surely it's all about the content of the conversation.
Okay, moving then on again quickly. And she was accused of throwing a banker to whom she owed money into fits using witchcraft. And that is echoes, doesn't it, of our own Lilith Ady. Somebody, the story of money being involved somehow. And that meant that people were being accused of witchcraft. And also, this woman, Joan Peterson, was offered clemency if she testified against other witches, and history records that she bravely said, "I'm not going to do that." And therefore, she lost her life.
She also used witchcraft. She was accused of using witchcraft to kill somebody called Lady Powell.
Yes. So yeah. I don't know what that was, whether or not she had anything to do with that.
Yeah, whether she was actually a murderer or just the women died of something and then they were like, well, what did she die of? And they didn't have a good reason.
Do you know what she definitely wasn't, though, Zoe?
Yeah.
A witch.
Yeah, I know.
That wasn't a difficult question. That was almost a rhetoric question there, Zoe.
Yes, I know, but I felt the need to answer it.
That's because I used my powers of cross-examination, Zoe.
Or your magical powers. Anyway, that's a horrible story. So she refused to testify against others and it was horrible.
I do not understand the bravery of somebody that says I won't testify against someone else to save my own life. I mean, takes such courage and spirit. I'm only ever in admiration when I hear these stories of incredible admiration that you wouldn't just go, do you know what? I'll get myself out of trouble and then maybe that person can get themselves out of trouble by doing the same thing and on and on and on.
Mm.
Anyway, we remember these people as those people who were caught up in a terrible time. They were women, they were men, but they were not witches.
Very true. And that brings us on to our guest for today, who we're very happy to speak to. And again, it's a book, a marvellous novel that she's written. So our guest today is Stacey Thomas, who has been a contributor to the Bad Form Review. She is an alumna of the Curtis Brown Creative Novel Writing course, where she was awarded the Claire McIntosh Scholarship for Black Writers. And in 2021, she was announced as one of the three winners of HarperCollins' inaugural Killing It competition for undiscovered writers. So she's here today to talk about her book, The Revels, which is her debut novel. She's also on TikTok. She's on Instagram. I'm sure she's on wherever she is because she's quite youthful. So go and find her on any of the different socials. She's absolutely lovely and the book's tremendous. I think you'll really enjoy it. So without any further ado, we welcome Stacey Thomas to the show. Hi there. We're delighted to have you on the podcast today because we've been following your pre-publication news about your book on Twitter. So we're wondering if the first thing you could do is just introduce yourself to the listeners, please.
Hi, everyone. My name's Stacey Thomas and my debut, The Revel, will be publishing Golden next month, the 20th of July. Set during the English Civil War, it follows a young man who's apprenticed to an infamous former witch hunter. The only problem is that he's a witch himself who can hear the dead sing. And my story is all about what happens as he finds love for the first time while getting drawn into a gruesome witch hunt.
Well, you're really good at that. That's good.
Oh my God,
really prepared.
I've had a lot of practice with all like the proof tools I've been doing.
Oh, that's good though, because it can be hard to encapsulate the book into like one or two sentences. And this is such a big story that's quite hard, I think, as a big task for you to work out what you're going to tell about the story, because it's quite unusual. We've done a few books that are fictions, that are novels about the witches in some way, lots of different angles. But we've not had an angle like this before. I don't think, Claire, correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but I don't think we've had one that's kind of from the perspective of a man.
No.
And yes.
Also, the sort of the spooky angle, I don't want to give too much away, but you've mentioned it there about the dead. That's quite unusual because normally it's very, very clear that the people that we're following tend to be the accused witches and they're innocent. And it's about kind of like a race against time, or it's just the terrible tale of them being found guilty in their death. But this is quite a different angle, isn't it?
Yes. So I would say firstly, I've always been obsessed like with the witch trials and then like any kind of books that have a witchy premise. And when I had the idea for The Revels, I did kind of play around with having a female protagonist, but then I was kind of like, there's so many good books like from a woman's perspective. And so I wanted to, like when I was writing, I was kind of like, what can I do that can kind of explore the kind of, you know, witchy stories that I love, but like make it kind of different so that I felt like excited about it. And that's why I wanted to write it from a male perspective, because especially if he's a witch, I can kind of explore those kind of gender dynamics and male vulnerability.
Yeah.
And then I would say like with the kind of the supernatural aspect, I know like in the books it's always been very clear that, you know, the witches, the women who were accused of witches were clearly innocent. And like in my case, in my book, like the people, the women who have been accused, like some of them have been witches and some of them have been, you know, innocent, like women and men as well, who have just basically been caught up in a political kind of game of cat and mouse. But I feel like I've always loved books with a supernatural element, so I just couldn't resist kind of, you know, having characters who are witches, but just because they are a witch, it doesn't mean that they've sold their soul to the devil for powers. They can also be good as well.
Zoe and I do enjoy a spooky book or two ourselves. Yeah. What was it that drew you to set the story historically in this time? Was it an area that you'd researched already?
I would say I've read like a lot of books kind of set in this period. So I read like The Mist over Pendle, and then also Ronald Bassett's The Witchfinder General, which is about Matthew Hopkins. And so I would say when I first started writing it, like I knew I wanted to sell it in the past. And then originally I was going to sell it during like the era of King James the First, just because, you know, he wrote demonology. He was in some sense the original witch hunter in that, you know, just with his paranoia, he really kind of made a platform for like, you know, for his courtiers to start kind of like doing their own witch hunting if they wanted to kind of get into his good graces. And then I think when I look back, I think I decided to set it during the Civil War because, you know, with the witch hunts, usually they kind of occur during, you know, political instability. And during the Civil War, it's like the world was kind of upside down. So I wanted to kind of show that, you know, many people were turning to witch hunting because there wasn't really a lot of structures in place to stop them because everyone was just occupied with the war effort. And so I wanted to show the kind of men or women who would be attracted to witch hunting and like how they would operate at a world where it's kind of like power is just up for grabs and everyone is trying to get what they can before the world kind of rights itself.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because I think what one thing that your book does that's unusual is it really shows the sort of the political machinations, like small p, between the different people with different powers and different families and, you know, their hidden secrets and how people can manipulate them because of that. And there's, you know, there are a few different characters that have got plots that are going on and they're trying to turn things to their own advantage. I find that really interesting, especially because of the people that were Catholic and now aren't Catholic and that vulnerability that they've got, even if they've got money and power.
Yes, like I like when I first started researching like the Civil War, like I was just really fascinated because like I hadn't even realized, I mean, I knew that obviously Catholics were persecuted, but I hadn't realized to what extent. Like in my book, I just mentioned as an aside that kind of Catholics at one point, I think it was someone called Pym, he wanted Catholics to wear a special kind of type of uniform. And I just remembered reading this in the book and I was like, wait, did this actually really happen? Like this
That's
is just
what I
absurd. It's true. Yeah, it's true. It was a suggestion that they made. And then obviously with if you were Catholic, you had to, you know, unless you were really, you know, entrenched in your beliefs, like you would be subjected to these fines. Like otherwise you would just have to pretend to be Protestants. So it was just that idea, like you were just constantly being persecuted and also likened to witches. So it was I just remembered like, oh my God, it's like, you know, not only did suspected witches have it bad, but like so did Catholics. So I really wanted to kind of like explore that in my book as well. And obviously with one character, you know, they're both a Catholic and a witch. So it's kind of that thing where it's like they've just been othered their entire life. So I wanted to show like, you know, like when you're kind of living in that situation, like, you know, sometimes you will like kind of maybe lash out against stuff because you're in that kind of, you know, fight or flight kind of mode.
Yeah. And it shows you sort of the lens that people will go to protect other people or to protect themselves. I think that's really interesting what you do in the book as well.
Thank you.
Can I ask, when you were researching like the Witchfinders and the Witchfinder General, one of my favourite facts about the Witchfinder General was he just announced himself as
yes.
The Witchfinder General, just walked into a village and said, I'm the Witchfinder General. What did you find out that interested you or surprised you about the practice that they had as experts to find witches?
So I would just say, I think What surprised me, I think, especially with Matthew Hopkins, was just how entrepreneurial he was. Like, you know, he would literally just announce himself as a like a witch hunter, and people actually took him seriously. And I think when he started, he was around 23. So, you know, this young, kind of relatively unseasoned man, and people just respected him. And I think it just showed how commercialized witch hunting was, because obviously, like, a lot of the suspected witches were, you know, poor women who were dependent on parish relief. And if you're a town that's struggling, you know, getting rid of them was a way to kind of make your town like a bit more financially solvent. And I think what just surprised me about witch hunting was just how, like, how they really relied on publicity. Because with Matthew Hopkins, he would actually kind of announce his services to towns in advance, like, and he would really kind of utilize pamphlets. And like with King Charles, like when he was kind of fighting for his crown, there was that freedom of the press. So you had all of these people. It's kind of like with Twitter, everyone's just kind of publicizing their ideas. So it was definitely like a free-for-all. So I found that like quite interesting. And I really wanted to just explore that in my book, like the idea that you could just say anything and there are people who are desperate enough, or, you know, desperate enough to believe you, or kind of, you know, use you for their own purposes.
I mean, sort of like a rock star coming into town,
I
isn't it? Like, so
know, I know, yeah. And
there's such fear, but also like you get a sense that there was an admiration for them too, that they were held up. You know, it's quite interesting in the world that you've painted in The Revels, that people are, even though there are people that have got secrets that they want to hide themselves, or they don't want to get involved in something directly without giving anything away, everybody is very taken with the idea of witches. You know, they're very quick to point the finger and create the story. And confessions come quite easily to people often. And they all buy into the story. But you realize, and I think this must be the case a lot, that the story of accusing somebody being a witch is more palatable and covers up other people's misdemeanors.
yes, like I like when I was like writing The Revels, like I read like real life like witch trials. And I remember one case where this mother and her daughter, her young daughter, I think her daughter might have been around 11 or 12, they accused their neighbor. They said they spied her through the door, basically sleeping with the devil. And like she turned into a dog, and the devil had her. And it's kind of like, so they really wanted to not only accuse this woman of witchcraft, but also humiliate her. And basically, the thing is, this was a neighborly dispute, but they were kind of using all their weapons in their arsenal to try to kind of permanently get rid of her. And so I felt like, you know, there was a case of, you know, some people, you know, did genuinely believe in the fear of the supernatural, but then there were other people who would just kind of use it to kind of settle scores as well. So it's really like, it was really kind of quite haunting to just read it.
Yeah, it was dangerous times when you fell out with a neighbor. They could just look through your letterbox. Did they have letterboxes then? Probably not. There wasn't a postal service, eh?
Yeah.
Look through the holes in the door and just,
Yes,
yeah, that
yeah.
was her with the devil last night.
I know.
And off it goes. I have to have a quick plug for The Crucible at the John Gielgud Theatre.
Oh, God. I've
Watch.
not seen it. I want to see it as well. It's at the National Theatre
Amazing.
now. Yeah.
Amazing. You should definitely go and see it. It's breathtaking, and it's very much the idea of a small town mentality of people so quick to point the fingers at one another, kind of not only because they admire the witch prickers, but also they're desperate. If they don't start pointing fingers, fingers will be pointed at them. So it's like
Yes.
a preemptive strike. It really brought it home to me how that was really important to get in there first with your complaints.
And I just remembered the film version as well. Like, and there's this sequence where it's kind of like it just all snowballs. Like one there's this sequence like one when one person accuses someone of witchcraft, it's like everyone's just joining in. And it's like, I love that scene, and I'm horrified by it, but you can just really kind of feel the hysteria kind of building up. And like, I definitely had that scene in mind, like when I was writing The Revels, and I have a church scene where everyone's like, oh, this person's a witch, like that person's a witch. And it's kind of like everyone is just kind of getting caught up in the heat of the moment. And yeah.
What's the response been so far, with your pre-publication? Have you had good responses from readers and so on?
So, I mean, I'm trying to stay away from Goodreads because it's like, you know,
Don't read reviews. Don't read reviews.
I know. I just remembered like one person, just like one fellow Wolfie, like she was just saying, just stay away from Goodreads, stay away. And like, you never really listen until like it's too late. But it's like, you know, luckily, like my agent and my editor and like my publishing team, they've all been really enthusiastic about the story. And I think everyone like is quite excited by the unique premise as well, like especially when I was like doing proof drops up north. And then I also like came up to Scotland as well. So I think like people kind of like the kind of male protagonist and the angle I've chosen to explore. So hopefully the readers will like it.
I love the supernatural angle with it. So it really kind of, it's interesting what he does. I don't want to give anything away, but he's got this magical power where so I'm not going to say anything. It's up to you if you tell anything about that. I really enjoyed that. I thought that was really creepy and it reminded me of something in particular, which I really liked. So I think that's got a really good angle to it. So it's different. It's a different take, definitely. Because there are a few novels out at the moment about witches, sort of different aspects of witches. But I think this stands out particularly because of the supernatural angle to it. So it's not straightforward.
And I feel...
I'll let you go. Yeah.
No, please respond to Zoe, whatever.
I was just going to say, like, I think for me, it was kind of like when I was writing, I was wondering, like, there was that kind of moment where I was kind of like, maybe I should make it true to life, because obviously the women who lost that meant the women and men who lost their lives to like the witchcraft, like trials, you know, they weren't like witches, they were innocent people. But then I also felt like I really wanted to explore that kind of supernatural aspect. And I feel like anyone who's, you know, seen the film The Sixth Sense and then will read my book can obviously tell like what my favorite movie was like when I was growing up.
I really love that. That's one film that I just always think I wish I'd not watched it so I could watch it again.
I've not watched it.
What?
you're missing out. You need to watch it when you have time.
I wish this podcast made the videos of the both faces were hilarious.
It's just a really interesting premise though, and I really like that. I think you've done it well, and I think that although, you know, I hear what you're saying there, that it's not just a kind of a polemic about the people were innocent and we need to remember that, you do get that across, that they're absolutely the victims of just scurrilous nonsense. But I think what you really get across is just how scary it must have been then that anybody could accuse you and you would just get swept along in it and you've really got no right of reply at all. And it just really got across to me sort of the fear that people must have lived in then.
No, it was just such a harrowing like time period. And then even like just kind of researching the torture methods as well. And I just remembered like while I was writing this and going through edits, I discovered your podcast. So it was like, it was just really interesting because it's like, I was just like going on like a listening binge. And it's like, at one point I had to stop because I was kind of like, oh God, if I can't keep adding stuff to my book. But it was like, I found Witches of Scotland, just the podcast, it was just such a useful tool of information. And I think especially when, I can't remember his name, but you were talking to someone who in Lancaster Castle, he went like down into the dungeon, and like that plays a part in my book as well. Just how he was describing it, like it really kind of helped me to kind of make the scene in my book like a lot more kind of sensory.
That's a big aim with the podcast, is to make it real for people, and whether they're using it to write something else or just to imagine what's going on there and really think about it. That's brilliant. I'm so glad that it was useful to you, and we really appreciate you. I don't know if you've seen this bit, but there's a bit in the acknowledgements where it mentions the campaign. So it's really nice.
Oh, yes. Like I wrote that and I added that in as well.
Good. It just means that more people will then know about the campaign that read your book, who maybe are reading your book, not necessarily because they're into what happened with the witch trials, but because they like the supernatural or whatever. And then they'll come across that, and then hopefully they'll know about the campaign too. So we really appreciate that. It's cool.
Oh, that's cool. Can I just point out to our listeners, I think that was episode 47.
Matthew, how do you remember, Claire?
Yes, I think that was it as well. Like I've listened to so many because you've interviewed Matthew Hopkins and then Danny Buckley as well. Yes, and it's like he was the reason when I was listening to him while I put in someone else. I can't remember his name. I'm terrible with names, but he was called the iconoclast, like general, the one who was going around smashing all the different religious imageries. So I have a little moment when one of my character kind of mentions him as well. I think his name was William Dowsing, the iconoclast general. Yes.
I'm kind of glad I haven't listened to it yet, Stacey. So I can go, yeah, I know that bit. Yeah, I've heard that bit.
That's a good shout out for Danny Buck as well. That's good.
Yeah. Can I ask, why is it called the Revels, or does that give something away?
Oh, it doesn't give anything away. And so basically, when I originally, with my character, he's an aspiring playwright. Originally, I was going to make him an aspiring kind of actor. But like, he's, even though he doesn't know his mother because she died in birth, what he does know is that she was an actress on the stage, like a minor actress. So it's kind of like with the Revels, it comes from the kind of this former like post called the Master of Revels. So in the kind of 17th and 16th century, the Master of Revels was the person who decided which plays would be performed in front of the royal court. And so I was just really kind of taken by the idea, firstly, because my protagonist, Nicholas, is obsessed with the theatre. And then also because in some senses, the witch trials are kind of like a play, like everyone is getting caught up. And it's sort of like with the Witchfinder General, in some sense, he's the master of revels because he is the one who is, you know, setting up this kind of play with the witch trials and deciding like who is going to be a part of it, like when you're looking at the kind of suspected, like, you know, victims as well. So I really wanted to get into the whole theatricality of the witch trials. So that's what inspired the title.
That is very cool. First of all, I love the idea of being a master of revels.
Like, yes.
I think they should bring that back, of somebody, a master of revels, that just tells you what's good on Amazon Prime and Netflix to watch.
I think that will be good because it's like whenever I log into like Amazon, it's like it takes me an hour to decide what to watch because there's so much choice.
But if you're a master of revels or mistress,
you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
We know where we'd be going.
Yeah.
Here, ask me at the end. I've got a couple of good TV ideas for you. I'll tell you after.
Okay. A good couple of TV ideas that you want to make up TV ideas or you want
Oh God, no, just stuff that I've seen that I'll tell you about that you might not have come across. Because it's just it's true. Do you talking of like TV adaptations, do you see that there could be like a film or a series version of your book?
I mean, I would hope so, just because like I know there is like a big appetite for like, you know, witchy stories, and I feel like, you know, my story is like I hope it doesn't sound like I have a big ego, but like I feel like it is like a unique take that like I feel like, you know, readers and like people watching it on TV would be drawn towards. And I feel like it's not really a story that I've seen before. Like the last film I've seen about like a kind of like a witch hunter, you know, set in the past was like that 1970s version called like Witchfinder General, which I would recommend as well, just because of how creepy it is. And I'd definitely love to see it adapted.
Yeah, I could really see it happening.
Stacey, could Zoe and I be extras?
Yes. I would want to be an extra as well. Yeah.
Cool. That'd be cool. Very cool. We could just be sundry witches.
Yes. Yeah. Sundry witches loitering at the back.
Yes. Yeah.
Could be people sitting kind of shaking our fists, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I would just be the one with the kind of just like the shaking my head when the witch hunt is like going past.
Yeah. Oh, Stacey, it's been really nice talking to you, and I think that this is going to be a big hit, I would imagine. I think that it's got it all, so you've probably got a pretty busy summer ahead of you promoting the book.
Yes, like I'm really lucky, like my publicist is lining up like a few kind of like panel events, so like the Waterstones in York in July, and then the Waterstones in Bristol in September, and like a few others that we're still firming up, but I'm really excited, and I'll be speaking with other like historical debut authors as well, so that's Brilliant. Really good too.
That's good. They should I think maybe it's too late now because it's in September, but Bloody Scotland, the Scottish Crime Festival. Ooh. That would be a good fit for maybe next September, if that's within their window of when your book comes out and so on, because it is a crime angle. So because it's the judge that's telling part of the story, or we're seeing what the judge is going through and evidence and all that kind of thing, I think that would sit really well with that. myself.
I'll email my publicist to like ask her to pitch me for it. Yeah.
Good call. And stay in contact with us and let us know where you'll be so we can let people know and they can come and see you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah, no, because it's like I definitely like want to come back down to Scotland because like the week I spent there just wasn't enough to kind of do everything I needed to. So yeah, no, I absolutely loved it.
Well,
yeah.
Let us know. Let's do coffees.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. Best of luck, and we'll follow your, I'm sure, your stellar writing career from this point forward.
Oh, thank you so much, and I will keep listening to all the upcoming podcasts as well.
Okay, you've done witches now. You probably don't want to do any further witch business from this point forward.
Okay. Well, if like I have ideas for like a sequel, hopefully for like book three. So yes, I need to stay like in the loop. Yeah.
Stay in touch for that then.
Zoe, we're gonna have to start coming up with some new witch facts.
God, yeah, we need to firm up the facts that we should already know by this point, Claire. But yes, okay, thanks so much for joining us.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, Claire, that's been another lovely experience, this latest episode 69 of the Witches of Scotland podcast.
Zoe, are we going to make any rash promises to listeners about getting out the podcast in another fortnight?
Yeah, if you like. I mean,
did you hear the commitment in our voice there to that happening?
Yeah, no, we can do that. I think we've recorded a few, so we've got some. So yes, I think let's make that commitment that we'll have another one out in a fortnight.
Yay!
If David's got time to produce.
Oh, that's true.
Tidy up the sound.
That's true. We always should say thank you to my brother David, and also to say that if you want to buy him a coffee, say for example, I always think that like if you've got a free podcast and you love it and you're getting something out of it. We don't want to charge for this because we want it to be as accessible as possible to people. But the number of people that we've gone out and met, Zoe, and they've gone, oh, let's get you a drink, you know, or they've invited us out for coffee. But David, the unsung hero, who does not stand in a pub going, yes, I'm the producer of the Witches of Scotland podcast, does not sadly get a pint or a coffee bought for him. So we'll link once again David's Buy Me a Coffee. And if you were to meet him in the street and think he's done a great job for free, very kindly, to get that information out there, get him a coffee.
Yeah. Or again, like the merchandise that we've got, remember that we don't get any of the money for that. What we do with that when we make anything, there's a really small profit margin. But anything there that we do for that, when we go to give that to David as well. So if you would like people to know that you're a fan of the Witches of Scotland by wearing one of the hoodies or having one of the mugs, then that's another good avenue as well.
And can I say a special shout out to our friend and listener, Sabrina, who has gone above and beyond with the merch. And I think the last time I saw, she was listening to the podcast. She was doing a jigsaw. She had her hoodie on and a mug.
Very good. Yes, that's very focused. Yeah.
And please do. We love seeing the photographs of the merch as well. And also, if seeing people with it begets other people with merch. Yeah. Yeah. So if you do
get in touch with us too on Instagram and Facebook and
TikTok,
Twitter and TikTok. So, you know, if there's anything, we do get people getting in touch with us, telling us about what they've been up to and like their kind of their family links to different things. And it's always really interesting. I'm just going to mention a couple of people that have been touched. I just want to give them a wee shout out. So we've had one listener, Kim Marie Jackson. So she's been in touch. She was born and raised in Wales, but she's got Scottish ancestry and is a big fan of what we're doing. She's now moved to Northern Ireland, and she was asking the question about what's happening with pardons in Wales, England and Northern Ireland. And I'd said to her that I didn't know exactly what was going on. There was talk a couple of years ago about an effort to have a pardon in England, but their route to pardons is extremely different to Scotland's because obviously it's just a different setup. But it's definitely worth, if you're living in any one of those areas and you yourself want to see a pardon, finding out who else is working in that area within that has an interest in pardoning the witches, definitely. We were also contacted by Megan Ann Bisbee, who was visiting Scotland, I think from the States, in June, sort of towards the end of June. And she said she had a wonderful time here, that it was a beautiful country and people were wonderful. And she started listening to the episode, the podcast, because she had bought Sarah Sheridan's Where Are the Women at Glasgow Cathedral when she's visiting. So it was really nice to hear from her. And that's just another sort of international listener. And people are just really wonderful for getting in touch and saying hello and just saying what it means to them. So thank you so much. And do please keep getting in touch with us, because it means the world to us to know that, you know, people are impacted by the podcast and that they're going out and then telling their networks about it. And the campaign sort of then grows. Just to give you a wee update, we don't know what progress has been made yet with what was happening in the Scottish Parliament, but we're hoping that we'll hear after the summer what's going to happen next. And of course, we'll update you when we do have some information about that.
Yeah, we absolutely will do. And also, if, dear listener, we could ask a wee favour of you as well. If you enjoy our show and you've told your friends about it, could you give us a review? It's not so much that we need to hear kind words, although, you know, we do react well to compliments, don't we, Zoe?
But, yes.
But it's because the algorithm also thinks, oh, this must be a good show if people are reviewing it positively. I'll push that up the algorithm and then more and more people get to listen about to it. So we'd really appreciate that if you're enjoying it, just dropping us. You don't even have to say anything. If you just see how many stars you'll give it, of course, Zoe and I would, you know, ask if you could consider giving us 5 stars. And if you could do that, that would be great. And it might mean more people listen to the podcast and get to know about the campaign.
That'd be cool. We'd really appreciate that. So until next time, which may very well be in a fortnight, adieu.
To you.
And you.
And you.
Bye.
Bye. If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.